like to do this afternoon is just to complete the reflection on this one discourse. See if there's any questions, and then to move on to the second discourse that I wanted to look at over this weekend. So what is interesting is that the Buddha's, you know, when it's put down like this, the Buddha's made this kind of very short journey to liberation. You know, he's gone from looking at two kinds of thought, you know, and it seems like a few passages later he's at the third noble truth. You know, this is the end of birth and I've done what needs to be done. It sounds like a very short journey. This is really for, you know, skillful means of presentation. What you will see in the discourses is the Buddha often is presenting many, many different portals, many, many different doorways of understanding to liberation. So they'll often be presented like in this way, or they'll be presented in the practice of metta, or they'll be presented in the practices of dependent arising. So he's not actually talking, I don't think, about many moments of liberation. He's talking about all these different doorways into understanding how suffering is created and how it comes to an end. So this is one of those ways. And as we go along in the suttas, you know, he says, ignorance was banished and true understanding arose. Darkness was banished and light arose. As happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. As happens in one who is diligent, ardent, and resolute. And then he uses this simile. He says, suppose, bhikkhus, that in a wood there was a great low-lying marsh near which a large herd of deer lived. Then a person appeared who desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage. And that person closed off the safe, good path that led to their happiness and opened up a misleading path. And he put out a decoy and set up a dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity, disaster, and loss. But another person came along desiring their good, their welfare and protection, and reopened the safe and good path that led to their happiness and closed off the false path and removed the decoy and destroyed the dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. He says, because I've given this simile in order to convey a meaning, and this is the meaning. The great low-lying marsh is a term for the craving for sensual pleasures. The large herd of deer is a term for all of the people who inhabit this world. The person desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage is a term for Mara. I know some of you might be familiar with this word, Mara. It's a kind of a one word that's used to describe every which way things can go wrong. And the false path is a term for the wrong eightfold path. That is wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration. And the decoy is a term for lust. The dummy is a term for ignorance. And the person desiring their good welfare is the person who cares for them, who is fully awakened. And the safe and good path is that of right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So there is a path that leads to happiness that's been opened and the wrong path closed off. This is what should be done out of compassion. And these are the roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus. Do not delay or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. So that's kind of the end. What's important here, because this is kind of going to segue into this next discourse I want to look at. The Buddha talks about ignorance, you know, and you'll see it on this next list. Some of you might not be able to see it. But the Buddha very much speaks out of, you know, distress and suffering are not caused just because we want to be distressed or want to suffer. That there are certain distortions of view that actually lead to the arising of suffering, and everything in the path in terms of the Eightfold Path, which really, really encompasses the whole of our life, is directing us to correct those core distortions, which we will go into in the next discourse. But before we move on, I just want to check, is there anything left over from this particular... Yes, please.
Just curious about fear and how it doesn't... to my experience, it feels like the underlying clinging or greed is a fear, and underlying the aversion is a fear, but it doesn't seem to be spoken of that way.
Well, fear and aversion are very much used... Fear and ill will are very much used interchangeably in Buddhist psychology. Although there is a separate word for fear, which is bhaya in Pali, but they're very much held under the same umbrella rather than as two distinct particular phenomena, even though they can be experienced differently. Mm. Yeah. Yes, please.
I have a question.
Yes, please. Well, that goes actually into another one of these discourses, which is in this actual short collection of discourses I spoke about that really speak about this world construction. And it's a discourse that very much speaks to the engagement of mindfulness and skillful effort. And in this sense, the Buddha doesn't speak about sort of one-dimensional effort. You know, he speaks about the many nuances of effort. And he actually, in that discourse, also... really addresses, you know, the very intractable and stubborn nature of many of these habit patterns. And you can almost look at ill will and sensual craving and harshness as well-established emotional habit patterns, you know, which is really how they're referred to in Buddhist psychology. So the Buddha really recognizes that these things just don't easily disappear. You know, I mean, you know, we have long histories of establishing those habit patterns. So he goes through this list. If you ever want to look at it, at this discourse, it's called The Removal of Distracting Thoughts. And he goes through this long list, which is about the engagement of mindfulness and wise effort. And it's interesting because it starts out, you know, fairly in places that are quite predictable, you know, because it starts out, well, first you're mindful of it. You know, that's the first step. I mean, nothing can change without mindfulness. And then he says, then you investigate it. Well, actually he says, if it still arises, you investigate it, you know. And then he says, and it goes on, he says, and if it still arises, take your attention elsewhere. And then he goes on, he says, if it still arises, cultivate whatever qualities are not present. You know, in the midst of ill will, cultivate metta, you know, cultivate generosity. And it goes on to say, and if it still arises, if it still arises, I think the next one, look at the outcomes. That's the next kind of engagement. Really reflect upon the outcomes of following this particular habit pattern. And then it goes on saying, if it still arises. So he's obviously talking about things that are really quite stubborn here, you know. So he's not just talking about stroking them with mindfulness, you know. He's actually talking about, like, really, they're still there. And then the next one, I think, he says, if it still arises, press your tongue against the roof of your mouth and don't go there. You know, which could be heard as being something really willful, or it could be heard as something as being very resolute, based on understanding of where this goes. He says, just put your tongue against the roof of your mouth and don't go there. And, you know, and it's kind of a sort of, it's sort of this question about feeding and fasting. You know, that for a habit pattern to sustain, there needs to be a certain amount of feeding. And sometimes fasting is important, you know, because, you know, feeding through repetition, feeding through narrative, feeding through reactivity, and sometimes even feeding through what looks like wise attention, but the attention is already implicated in the pattern because it's got an agenda to get rid of the pattern. You know, so it's actually feeding it just through the kind of attention that is being brought to it, even though on the surface that attention can look really well-intentioned. You know, I'm working on something or, you know, I'm working something out. It's actually, I still may be feeding it. So he says, put your tongue, you know, just don't go there. And I'm sure there's situations many of us can think of where it would be just a good idea just to not go there. Rumination, obsession, you know, fantasy, rehearsal. There's probably a number of habit patterns that we think it would just be useful just not to go there. Not because they're wrong, not because they're bad, but because I know where they go, and I know that going there will almost kind of guarantee their repetition. And the last of the efforts I think I spoke about, it says if it still arises, ask for help. Which is also a useful thing to remember. So I think that's what he means by you know, this abandoning, removing. It's not, again, a one-dimensional approach. You know, there's a lot of nuances in that. And I think that's a kind of art of meditative practice, you know, is that we hold that level. We don't just have a one-size-fits-all approach. You know, we learn the kind of nuances of what is helpful, what is actually helpful in this moment, to actually sort of, you know, interrupt that habit pattern that we know is unhelpful.
Just on that point, it sounds counterintuitive, that step of if it still arises, turn your attention somewhere else. Isn't that just distraction? Isn't that what we're trying to avoid?
Well, no, it is kind of counter, you know, it's counter sort of contemporary mindfulness teaching where, you know, you kind of hear the message, you know, stay with it, stay with it, stay with it, you know. Whereas actually in Buddhist teaching, you would never actually prescribe that approach. You would always say, you know, sometimes if it still arises, look at, you know, take your attention elsewhere because you may be feeding it. You may be feeding it, and it may be this kind of, you know, act of sort of endurance. You know, I'm just going to bear this or endure this, you know. Whereas actually there may be such a state of mind present that there's no room for actually any shifting to take place, you know. So it's like if the mind is very contracted, you know. Or, you know, I often think of this when I work with people with chronic pain, for example. You know, because we know how chronic pain, of course, quite naturally sort of draws the attention, you know, and there can come a feeling, well, I have to stay there, I have to stay with it, I have to stay with it. Actually not appreciating how contracted the mind is becoming. You know, and often when I've been teaching people with chronic pain, I'll often suggest to them, find somewhere in your body that's neutral, you know, that's not involved in the pain cycle. And move your attention between the two. Learn something about coexistence, you know, that although the pain is there, there's also this place in the body that's quite well. And then I come back to the pain. But there's some very important lesson to learn in practice. I think about coexistence and about peaceful coexistence. You know, sometimes the mind is very contracted in an obsession or a rumination. And the nature of the contractedness is a kind of forgetfulness, that even though that obsession is there, you know, the birds are still singing. You know, the wind is still moving the branches. And maybe if I take my attention away to actually notice this, it's not about moving into reverie or moving into distractedness or moving into forgetfulness. It's actually taking our attention somewhere else that reminds us that this is not the entirety of my moment. You know, this pain is not the entirety of my moment. This obsession is not the entirety of my moment. That this is coexisting with this. And by actually bringing that information in, easing the contractedness. Yeah. Yes, please.
What about a sense of judgment that might arise when observing the choices that we making that aren't wholesome. And then from that, the impossibility of doing that to other people.
Yeah. And I think it's very important to really really get a felt sense of the difference between a sort of sense of wholesome shame and what we call judgment, you know, because they're very different creatures, you know. And it's good, I mean, it's just good to know that in Pali there isn't a word for judgment. I mean, there is a word, very clear word for discernment. You know, discernment's really, really important, discerning what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering, what is helpful and what is unhelpful. It's a very clear word for that, but, judgment is our cultural word. And I think we need to be a little bit careful with it, because I think sometimes people are so, you know, they've beaten themselves up so much with self-criticism and self-judgment that they're almost afraid to exercise their discerning capacity. But, if we think about what is actually happening in what we call judgment, is this a self-inflicted aversion? It's a self-directed aversion. And, this tendency towards aversion, towards ill will, doesn't actually really have a very much of a discriminating nature or very much of a conscience. You know, if we turn that that aversion inwardly, we will, of course, have the same pattern operating in relationship to others. If we have well developed the tendency to turn aversion inwardly towards ourselves, we will be generous with that habit pattern and we will turn it outwardly. It doesn't actually have a sort of discriminating nature of this is only for me and never for you. Any other questions before we move on? You're all exceedingly clear and have come to the third noble truth. Right. Good. Glad to hear that.